Act of Isms is all about introducing you to new ways to engage. And we understand that every purchase you make is a vote for what you believe in.
So naturally, we gravitate towards mission-driven companies, which is why we've partnered with Wayakea. Wayakea is a brand built on three values that Act of Isms can confidently stand behind.
Healthy, sustainable, and ethical.
That's right. This volcanic water is naturally filtered through thousands of feet of lava rock, enhancing it with a unique blend of minerals, giving your body an alkaline pH.
Wayakea uses 100% post-recycled RPET bottles, low-emission shipping, and actively participates in regional reforestation, making them one of the first certified carbon-neutral beverages on the planet.
And best of all, for every liter of Wayakea you buy, Wayakea donates 1 week of clean drinking water to those in need.
So if you're going to buy bottled water, buy with Mother Earth in mind.
Go to store.wayakeasprings.com and use offer code ACTOFISMS to get a 10% discount on your first purchase or delivery subscription. When you support Wayakea, remember, you're also supporting this podcast. So thank you very much.
All right, now let's get into this episode.
Let's do it. Hi, I'm Tyler Batson. I'm a documentary filmmaker and activist who's traveled the world to prove that peace is possible, even in the most unlikely spaces. And this is Act of Isms, a podcast creating opportunities for connection and compassion through conversation and action. Welcome back to part two of our discussion on the queer revolution happening in the Christian church. First off, thank you so much to everyone who wrote in, called me, texted, or left a review. This conversation really struck a chord with many of you, and it is a privilege to continue learning with you today. In part one, we heard from Jonathan Randall Grant and Michael Vasquez, two theologians that invited me into their world to explore the challenges and successes in each of their very unique fights for LGBTQ inclusion in the church. But as Jonathan pointed out, not all LGBTQ exclusion comes from the church, and it's actually kind of a unique thing in the United States that it does. So today, we're going to zoom out a little bit and tackle the cultural, political, and social intersections of the conversation with Alicia Crosby and Tim Wolf, two more leaders in this robust movement who are going to help us cut through the temptation to demonize the church in an attempt to truly practice what we preach. Alicia, this is Tyler.
Hey, how's it going?
Jonathan has told me so many great things about you, but maybe the best place to start is just with your name and what you do.
Oh, absolutely. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. So I'm Alicia Crosby. I am the co-founder and executive director of the Chicago-based nonprofit Center for Inclusivity. We do work curating public forums for dialogue and work towards inclusivity and equity from that position. In addition to that, I am a speaker and writer and facilitator, just really working to undo and address the systemic, spiritual, and interpersonal harm that people experience in the world.
That's no small feat.
I try.
Where did that drive come from?
When we work to speak about what it is that people experience in the world and talk about their histories, whether they be personal histories or the collective histories, like of peoples, of groups, that can be incredibly healing work. It could be liberating work. And I wanted to do what I could to address the harms that people experience in the world.
Have you yourself ever experienced any of these harms?
Oh, heck yeah. Absolutely. And some of those harms, I think, are a little bit easier to talk about. I've been very fortunate in that I haven't been a survivor of any type of physical assault, but probably most clearly in my mind, I've had to navigate, surviving spiritual abuse.
Spiritual abuse. Okay, let's just settle on that term for a second, because it gives me the chills, to be quite honest. Centers of spirituality are not supposed to abuse its devotees. Can you tell us some more of the ways that you've experienced spiritual trauma?
So, I mean, being a Black queer woman, there's a fair amount of violence that I've encountered just because of the identities that I hold and the way that I navigate the world. But I remember being young and working for a church when I was in my early 20s. And one of the things that was super heartbreaking is the way that the idea of gender and more specifically gender roles were used in, I guess, in tandem with some spiritual manipulation to control me. And so I'll never forget, I had a conversation with a supervisor at the time and another leader within the church around a prayer meeting the pastor wanted the staff to go to. And like, I got to the point where I was just feeling like this worship service was compulsory. Like I felt that it wasn't something I was giving God of my own accord. I felt like I was being forced to do it. And I stopped going. And it just happened to also be that I was dealing with some like, you know, some health issues at the time. I had gotten like in a car accident and like was in like physical therapy. Like I took that time that I would have to be in service to like go to the therapist. And so they sat me down and told me that they felt my not attending was actually an issue of my submission, that I wasn't submitting to the pastor. And that was indicative of the ways in which I was not going to be able to submit to my future husband.
What?
Yeah. So imagine being like 22, 23 years old, all bright eyed and bushy tailed for Jesus, like to the point where you decide to go work in a church. And that's what you're told because you, A, made a decision to not give something to God out of someone else deeming it to be a necessity and you wanted to give it freely, but also that you're like physically in pain because like you're actively healing from a car accident that you got in and you were using that time for your healing. But we're told that because this was the time that you took, that you weren't good at submitting to someone's will. And that's like so freaking toxic. It's so toxic. And what was so sad is, you know, both of them had shared like stories from their personal lives. So like my director at the time was a woman and this other leader was a man. And so, and both of them were cisgender. And so, you know, the woman was just like, hey, so, you know, there are times where my husband says something and I don't like it and I have to yield to him. And then the guy like chirps in and he's like, yeah, and my wife sometimes submits to me, you know, and she doesn't agree, but, you know, we're honoring God and like in what we do. And so this is like incredibly toxic language. And I didn't have the ability to like to verbalize that then. But what I did have the ability to do is that as much as I love them and as much as I respected them, that they didn't have the right to talk to me this way.
You told them that?
Yeah, I told them that. I told them that flat out. Like, I love y'all. Y'all don't know me well enough to have this conversation with me. Like, this is not a thing that we're going to continue on in. And I'm proud of my former self, right? Because I was young. I mean, like, seriously, I was 23 years old, like a year out of college when this conversation happens. And I realize now that that was like incredibly, you know, emotionally manipulative, playing on the insecurities that I had as, you know, this young single woman who like desired to be married. I mean, there was so much focus, like even in the church and like in many churches that are evangelical in nature, that the singles be married and like you have to prepare yourself to be somebody's spouse, blah, 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 blah. So like they were playing on that insecurity, then tying into like, you know, into it that I was not submitting to the pastor's will. And then tying on to that, that this was going to like, you know, cause problems for me later on in life. Like that was so toxic and so manipulative and so abusive. But the sad thing is, I don't think that they recognized that then. And, you know,
but how could they not?
Oftentimes, in order to understand that something is abusive, we may know that it's wrong and like and feel it in our guts. But it's life and experience and journey and learning that helps us see that certain things aren't right. And then we acquire language over time to name the ways and not only in which it was not right, but that it's like definitively wrong and violent and hurtful and damaging to people.
So you're not working toward an eye for an eye.
No.
You're actually working in collaboration with people and institutions to heal the abused and the abusers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because at the end of the day, it's like, you know, like, yes, there's the parts of me that is definitively like activistic, but I think that like activism or good activism should be about our collective liberation. And so like when, you know, the whole eye for an eye philosophy, I think gets lived out in its most extreme iterations, not everybody gets free. We all need to get free, whether that be those of us who have been oppressed and those who have acted as our oppressors. And so as much as I want, you know, to see the folks who've endured violence that's led to trauma be freed, I want to see those who have perpetuated that violence freed as well.
Maybe that's the chance for peace. It's not a matter of just waking folks up. I found this in my own work, actually. You hear these rally cries like no justice, no peace. But I say it's the other way around. Why are we asking for justice from a system that we know is broken? It's peace that must come first, healing. And the church leadership is in need of peace and healing too. They're the ones carrying out all this hate and fear. The rest of us are just reacting to it.
Jesus consistently, like, you know, through and through is like love, love, love. The point of the law is love. Love God, love others. Like Jesus teaches us that love is cyclical. And at some point, love will give itself to justice.
Okay, I wholly believe in the power of love, but something's obviously in the way because that alone is not working. People are operating under a counterfeit version of Christianity that allows hate and exclusion to be part of their doctrine. So if we're going to create radically inclusive churches, where in God's name do we start? Pastor and church planter Tim Wolf points out that the solution may lie in reforming not just the church, but the American cultural identity. He took me on a walking tour of his neighborhood in Chicago to explain.
You know, Americans are the ones who want to lay exclusive claims on Christianity. American Christianity is, you know, the best and the brightest, and God only likes us. God's kind of, you know, God's kind of like the gracious host. All the other people can come in, those good Muslims, but the goal is to turn them into Christians. You know, here come the Jewish folks, let's make them Jews for Jesus, quick, fast, and in a hurry, you know.
Would you say that it's no surprise that they came up with this idea of the quote-unquote gay agenda?
Oh, yeah. Everybody's always had an agenda. Listen, the church in America has always needed someone to bully. Always.
Why? Why?
Because there is this problem in America in terms of status and rank, and we are always competing. This competitive nature in America. Why would I belong to a church if it's not the right one? And if your church is right and my church is right, and we don't really agree in our doctrine, then how do I know I'm in the right one? And is that the best one then? And then I'm not having the best. Because all Americans worry about is being out in front, not just keeping up with the Joneses. We gotta do better than the Joneses, always. You know, why aren't you're making B's in school? Why aren't you making A's? You know, oh, you got into Yale? Why didn't you get into Harvard? Yeah. It's never good enough. And that is this kind of acquisitiveness that I think is part of the American character. So yes, the only way that I can feel secure that I'm in the best church is to make sure that all the other churches stink. And how else can I do that than by saying they all stink, they're all wrong, they're all going to hell. You know, those Catholics, they're idolaters, you know? Those, you know, I'm now a Presbyterian, but I grew up a fundamentalist. Those Presbyterians, they don't believe anything. Those Methodists, they're all backslidden, you know? The Baptists are okay, but they're still a little wonky because they have this idea that once God saves you, you're saved forever. That's wrong.
I'm gonna stop there, that's really good.
Just like in the days of the early church, Tim invited me into his home to continue the conversation. We each had other places to be, but as you can imagine, I was eager to hear more of Tim's point of view, and luckily he was eager to share. Was this whole issue just a perfect storm of the American ego and idealism? If so, then Alicia's right. It's not a matter of the people versus the church. As Americans, we all have to check ourselves. We can start with love, sure, but in the blame game that the search for justice invariably produces, love finds itself in a state of resistance. Sound familiar? We're all in a state of resistance. The country is in a toxic relationship with itself. So, now that we've named the problem, how do we mitigate it so love can finally push through hate? Tim has a suggestion.
Deal with your own stuff. I am so tired of everybody blaming everybody for everything. Nothing is anybody's fault in America. It's always somebody else's fault. Look at this president. You know what? It's the FBI's fault. It's somebody else's fault. It's always somebody else's fault. The Bible says, work out your own salvation. Where you fit into this picture is dealing with your own stuff.
A lot of people would say, if we're putting this into the political climate context, mm-hmm. A lot of people would say, I have good reason to be angry.
Yeah. So be angry. That's okay, but deal with your own anger. That's your own stuff. The old saints used to have a song that said, nothing between my soul and the Savior. What is all that's in between me? What is all that stuff that's preventing me from being 100% open and ready and willing and the ability to check myself? Doesn't mean that I don't have, you know, people say, oh, then you have no standards. That's not what it means. I have my own standards. I have my own moral compass. I have my own belief of who's right and who's wrong. But I'm not anybody else's police. And that makes all possible. But the minute that I become the arbiter, and people, I love this. I can't condone that. Who are you to condone any? Nobody asked you. There was no condemnation request submitted to you. You know, no one asked you to condone things. And I don't know where you think that your condemnation in any way, shape, or form affects me.
Would you say that the shift is required of us as a society to come to a place of more acceptance, more compassion, more unity?
Yeah, but I think we got to get it out of Hallmark Village. This is, I'm not going to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. Can't we all get along? Oh, those are placebos. It comes from a very real conversation you have with yourself about your own weaknesses, knowing what those are. Am I naturally suspicious of people of color? I need to deal with that instead of running around calling everybody else a racist. I got some of that stuff in my house. So let me work on my house. And meanwhile, trust that everybody else is working on their house. And if they're not, let them get around me and watch me work on my house. That might inspire them to work on their house a little bit. But I can't inspire them if I'm yelling at them for their house being a wreck when I still got sweeping and cleaning to doing my own. So the answer for me is not to decide who's welcome into my arms. And the answer is to bring everybody into my arms. That's a different kind of world than my confidence in myself and my own moral stature and my own moral certainty. Certainty is just problematic, and it's really problematic for Christians because we're taught we can't live by certainty. We live by loyalty, by faith. Faith is loyalty. It's not certainty. And that's a big difference. Faith means I believe this. I trust what Jesus taught. I trust the promises of God that I find in Scripture, and I'm going to remain loyal to that belief in spite of everything. That's faith. But a lot of people mistake faith for certainty. That's different.
That's insecurity is what it is.
No, it's ignorance is what it is. It's just flat out ignorance. Look, my own family, diehard fundamentalists, they have still not known what to do with me. They're all sure I'm going to hell. My father called before he passed away and said, I just told God I don't care if I get to heaven because you're not going to be there.
Your dad said that to you?
Said that to me. He meant well. He was just trying to be honest with me. But he couldn't say, you know, just couldn't do it. So I was very angry about all of that. And I don't know what to do with this. I don't want any part of them. And I went down that hole. If they're such Christians, how can they not, you know, that else? Such an adolescent argument. You know, oh, how can they call themselves Christians? You know, what are we talking about here? And it was one of those moments where all of a sudden I had this epiphany. Where it was, I would honestly say that it was almost like the Spirit of God just grabbed me by the back of my shirt and said, hang on here, Buster. How are you calling yourself a Christian? If you're not willing to accept them in their weakness and in their hatred and in their prejudice, acceptance is acceptance. And you're saying, because they won't accept what they see wrong in me, I don't have to, you know, you're not accepting what you see wrong in them. Could it be that maybe you're the stronger one? What's the call that's on you? You're responsible for you, not them. And if you let them shape what you believe and the way you behave, then that's on you. They don't get blamed with that. That doesn't go on their charge. So shouldn't you be loving them the way you want to be loved? Isn't that do unto others as you would have them do unto you? Where's that? How's that working for you right now?
Where is that right now in society as we see it now?
It's got to come. We're going to have to do something new. And that's a queer idea. It's the queerest time there ever has been to be alive. We have all of these rules, but right now we are in deep, deep conflict about what the right rules are. Because our relationship with our maker and with the cosmos and with everything is always in flux. And it's a generational conflict. It's a racial conflict. It's a gender-based conflict. It's a sexual conflict. It's a cultural conflict in every sense of the word.
And yet you're seeing people coming together and people and the church actually existing in harmony.
Well, the church, so let's work about the idea of church. In America, there has been a huge secular movement that's been happening right under the radar because we've been focused on this mega church
fundamentalist stuff is the only place that allegedly Christianity is growing. We always hear, so you go to conferences and it's all the churches are dying. It's the end of Christianity. We're moving to the post-Christian era and all this kind of stuff, except in the evangelicals, because they're going to save the whole world, right? What's happening is they have turned their churches into these big, giant entertainment centers where there's not only
the evangelicals.
Yeah. Which are not, there's not even any doctrine left. There's not even any dogma or taboos left for them. It's just showbiz. And so what has happened is they have now raised two generations through this. And this second generation is not so much, it's not that they're not buying it. They just, it's like, yeah, this is the culture I grew up in. There are some kids that are very diehard. Yes, of course there are, and really big believers. And yes, their churches are still strong, but there are a whole lot of them that are just going there because that's where their family goes. Happens to every new movement. The second generation down, it's like, yeah, this is all I know. But they're not believing it. So I had a pastor. I'll tell you a great story. I went to a Christmas extravaganza for a church down south in Alabama. You're in a town of about 50,000 people in Alabama, and this church has a membership of about 5 or 6, so about 1 in 10 members of citizens of this town belong to the church, right? And it's a big, huge mega church. And in the middle of it, I can't even begin to explain the logic behind it. There was none evident. there was just none. They were doing all of this pop stuff. The first half of the show, there was Santa Claus and the Disney princesses, and Iron Man was hanging from the ceiling at some point. And,
what?
Oh, I've got pictures. I can prove this. And in the middle of it, it's time for the kids to do something hip, but what do you do with this? It's a predominantly white church. You're not going to drop any Kanye. All right. You're not. But, you know.
Easy.
Yeah. There's going to be, you know, no. Well, I don't even think Kendrick was working. But you're not going to drop any of that, right? So they come up with this idea. They put them all up in, like, gang bandanas and jeans and stuff. And they're dancing up, doing this choreography. And they're twisting their fingers around like they're doing gang signs. Which, having worked in gang, honest to God, gang work, where you watch your hands at all time, I was just sort of appalled at that. But here's the number that they're dancing to. They're doing YMCA, complete with the YMCA with their arms, right? And they're doing this sort of weird conflated gang number with YMCA. And they've got this big, huge screen behind them with the Village People video behind it.
What?
Yes, part of the Christmas program. Eventually, they do get Jesus born in the presence of living camels and sheep paraded across the stage. And, oh, it's just really a Barnum Bailey's kind of Christmas. And so it's over. And I was with my parents, who are ministers, in this same tradition that this church is in, a tradition I got out of a long time ago. And my dad just sort of hung his head, and he goes, it's an embarrassment. And I said, I'm just pissed off. And I said, if you walked into any gay nightclub in America, and saw all the boys with their shirts off, you know, tucked in the back of their pants, and all the glitter falling from the ceiling and everything, and we were doing this to one of your beloved hymns, Amazing Grace, or you would tell us we had no business doing that. We don't know what that song is about. How dare you? I said, I am in a church that won't have me as a member, that continually tells you that I'm going to hell, and you seem to believe it. And in the meantime, you're using our culture for your own amusement. That is not yours. That is not yours to have, and you can't have it. And I'm going to explain to you what you just did, because either somebody hates this church and suggested it so you would be embarrassed, or else you're also ignorant that you should not say one word about homosexuality in America ever again. But I'll tell you what YMCA is all about. YMCA is a song about a bathhouse. YMCA is about how much fun it is to get in a place where you can have indiscriminate sex with strangers. Young man, there's no need to feel down. That's right. There's always fun to be had at the YMCA. And those Village People, that, you know, the mechanic and the leather guy and the policeman and they are all gay porn stereotypes from the 70s. You have put up a gay porn movie in your Christmas program. And if you knew it and did it, then you're wrong. And if you didn't know it and did it, you're twice as wrong. So my father says to me, would you say this to the pastor? And I said, absolutely, go get George. I've known this man forever. So I explained it to him, and he was just, his head was like, he was agog. It's like, we had no idea. It's like, then you should never ever talk about homosexuality from the pulpit. If this is how little you know, to not know what you've just done, you've got no point talking about homosexuality. But I want you to keep talking about it, George. I do. I want you to keep talking about it. And he looked at me, and I said, I do. And I said, because there are people in your church, young people, who every time you get up and you tell this baloney lie that all queer people do is they all have, you know, S&M chambers in their house and they all molest little children and they're all miserably unhappy because they're not living the way God wanted to live. Keep telling that story. And the young people in your church are saying, yeah, it's not true with my cousin and her wife. My teacher and his husband don't behave like that. Our neighbor down the street, he's always got some new guy on his arm, but he's happy. He doesn't hurt anybody. Keep telling that story. See, we messed it up when we came out, George. We messed your story up. And so keep telling that story. And then they're going to say, what else is he lying about? And then what happens is they're all going to leave these churches that you guys have built. And they're going to wind up in my church where we tell the truth. And we know theology is queer. And we know that it's the queer is okay because that's how God made us. So just keep doing it. It's okay. I'm all right with it. You're helping me out. To this day, he calls me from time to time just to ask me some questions because there are things he now thinks he doesn't understand. But that's what has to happen, is we have to get ourselves back in touch with the queerness of Christianity, the queerness of theology. Immediately calls for us to look at any doctrine, dogma, taboos, anything with suspicion, because human existence and nature by itself is queer. None of us is born alike, right? So we are all queer because we're all unique. That's queer all by itself. Does that make sense?
I'm crying right now, so I think that makes perfect sense.
I don't want you to cry.
No, it's beautiful.
You know?
These are not the pathways to the church that people, or that I certainly ever hear of.
Right. That was the pathway to the church. Here's what I would tell anybody who's looking to move into a different kind of theological arena. Theology is all about uncertainty. It's all about, we can't say anything for sure. This is where faith comes in, right? I'm going to be loyal to this belief, but belief is not fact. But that belief is pivotal, and it enables you and empowers you to say to other folks who present oppressive ideas, exclusionary ideas, racist, sexist, all those, the things we hate. You just look at them and say, I don't believe that. And they say, well, you have to. It's like, I don't believe I have to believe that. Well, you're going to pay. You know, God said, and you'll go to hell for that. Well, I don't believe that either. You have the power to decide what you believe and don't believe. That's the personal piece of this. My belief, not the claim, my personal claim on Jesus or Christianity. I have no personal claims on all of those things. Those belong to everybody. I can't claim Jesus as my personal savior. Jesus is not my valet. Jesus is not my servant. No, my belief and faith and trust in Jesus brings me into a body of millions of believers, billions across the ages. Can't be the least personal faith there is. But my personal beliefs are my guide, and that empowers me to look at people who have oppressive ideologies and oppressive. It's not, oh, we all live together in peace. That's just kind of naive. I have to be able to look at people whose ideologies are oppressive and harmful and dangerous for me and tell them, I don't believe what you believe. But I can't say you're wrong. I have to just say, I don't believe what you believe. And that liberates me from you. The conversation's over. We don't need to argue about this. I don't believe that. So there's no argument here. There's nothing to parse. And we've got to move into that kind of realm with this and shake some of this stuff free.
And what you believe is that God and theology is.
I believe that God is the source of everything. So God is the source of wealth. And God is the source of sunshine and crops and prosperity and health. But now we just want it. We don't want nobody else to have it. So now we take all of that goodness, and now the answer is we become acquisitive, right? Now we want more of that goodness. And if we can monopolize that goodness, then we have all the power. This is now how we take good things and turn them bad. God's not the source of that. So God is queer because God is everything. And that's a mighty queer way to be. And yeah, that's just how it is. It's just God is queer. God can't be anything other than queer because God will not fit in anybody's categories, right? And if Jesus is fully human and fully divine, that's real queer all by itself too. And so if I'm going to be a follower of Jesus, I should just be queer. I mean, that's just what I should be. I need to be queer.
I love
that. Yeah. Well, that's what I see. So.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you guys so much for tuning in. It was an absolute pleasure indeed to go to Chicago, explore this story, and bring a new, vibrant, and hopeful perspective to this very serious problem. Activism has really grown since episode one, and the demand for new episodes is hot on our heels. So in order to continue to bring you these powerful, activated, and compassionate voices, we're introducing a crowdfunding feature to keep activism going strong. Go to patreon.podbean.com/activisms to donate today. We've also linked that in the description of this and every episode. We'll be setting monthly goals, and this month we're hoping to reach $500. That's going to help fund the cost of our editing software, a new audio recorder, and so much more. All for just $500. Can't donate? We still strongly encourage you to share this episode, tell your community why it matters, and leave a review on iTunes. Simple acts like this will help expand a message of compassion that we all so desperately need right now. Don't forget to follow, like, and subscribe on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and now YouTube at ActivIsms. And special thanks to Jonathan Randall Grant, Michael Vasquez, Alicia Crosby, Tim Wolf, and Emily McGinley for their work and for adding their voices to this rich conversation. And to Maria, our interns Amal and Cristiano, you guys rock. And of course, Collier for allowing us to use his brilliant song here, Lost in Your Love, available on Spotify. We love you guys. We'll be back next week with even more content. But in the meantime, keep listening up for opportunities for connection and compassion through conversation and action.